From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, my guest is Paul Sorum. We'll be discussing the French healthcare system, which was recently rated by the United Nations as the top healthcare system in the world. Then, in our Viewpoint segment, Dr. Sherwood Gorbach will discuss the dangers to the public health of adding antibiotics to the feed of farm animals. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our first news item today concerns the Proteome Project. The National Academy of Sciences is hosting a meeting February 25th to launch a project to characterize all the proteins in the human body. The project, called the Proteome Project, is a direct offshoot of the Human Genome Project. Over the last 12 years, $3 billion has been spent to characterize the entire human genome, a project which was completed ahead of schedule. Interest in characterizing protein structure has heightened with the near completion of the Human Genome Project. Now that the scientists have nearly completed the identification of all the human genes, interest has turned to proteins. Proteins are the large molecules that are the workhorses for the cellular activity of all animal and plant cells. Protein structure is what the genes code for. Genes all have a similar double helical structure. Unlike genes, proteins are large molecules, each of which has a unique three-dimensional structure. And each part of a protein has a specific electrical environment. These features are key to understanding how each protein functions, and also how malfunctioning proteins act in different disease states. If a protein is twisted into the wrong shape, or is missing a part, then disease may result. Eventually, understanding protein structure and inherited variations in proteins among individuals should help treat a great variety of diseases. Technical advances, some quite recent, more effectively applying computers to X-ray diffraction, electrophoresis, and other techniques, have led to optimism that the task of identifying the 100,000 human proteins is achievable in the next 10 to 20 years. Several influential leaders at the National Institutes of Health have already indicated that this effort will receive a great deal of funding over the coming decade. The National Institutes of Health is a branch of the federal government and is by far the largest source of funds for medical research in the U.S. and provides far more funding for basic medical research than all private sources combined. Scientists at Harvard Medical School and the Argonne Lab near Chicago have already begun to devote significant resources to the proteomics effort. The Journal of the National Cancer Institute reported this month that the use of tanning booths are strongly linked to the development of skin cancer. A research group from Dartmouth Medical College interviewed 603 people who had just been diagnosed with basal cell carcinoma and 293 with squamous cell cancer. They also spoke to 540 people who did not have skin cancer. Sunbathing, tobacco use, and other relevant factors were evaluated in the study, but did not alter the conclusion that tanning booths cause skin cancer. Those who said they had used a tanning lamp or sunbed were 2.5 times as likely to be in the squamous cell cancer group and 50% more likely to be in the basal cell cancer group, compared to those who said they had never used tanning booths. There were not enough people in the study to check for melanoma, the most deadly form of skin cancer, but researchers believe it likely that tanning booths increase the risk of melanoma as well. Most tanning parlors use the wavelengths of ultraviolet light in the UVA spectrum that doesn't tend to lead to sunburn. Unfortunately, it can still lead to cancer. Researchers said tanning salons and sun lamps might need closer regulation, now determined by states, and suggested that minors be banned from using them, and that anyone who uses a tanning booth should be required to sign a consent form acknowledging the cancer risk. Finally, the February 9th issue of the British Medical Journal is devoted to the effects of military conflict on public health, which was also the topic of the last airing of Public Health Radio. Several studies appeared in the issue documenting the disastrous effects of 20 years of war on the population of Afghanistan. One article in the issue reviewed the impact of the military conflict in the occupied territories of Palestine. Research carried out by the Institute of Community and Public Health at Bir Zeit University near Ramallah shows that about 13% of the injuries sustained by Palestinians during the conflict are likely to result in irreversible disability. A total of 33,000 injuries have been sustained up to now, so the number of people left disabled will be substantial. Unfortunately, there are only 71 hospital beds in 4 hospitals available to treat traumatic injuries in the entire West Bank and Gaza combined. Analysis of the most recent 6,000 injuries found that 25% were sustained by school children. The study found that the injuries most likely to lead to permanent disability were those inflicted by the fragmentation bullets fired by Israeli M16s, a U.S. lightweight field rifle. The bullet is designed to break into tiny pieces after penetration, ripping up muscle and nerve, and causing multiple internal injuries with a high likelihood of long-term irreversible disability. This weapon is similar to the internationally banned dum-dum bullet. The same issue contains an article reviewing the disastrous effects on the civilian population brought about by the war in the Congo. The World Health Organization estimates that 2.5 million excess deaths occurred in the country between 1998 and 2001. Infant mortality has been reported as high as 370 per thousand, and a whopping maternal mortality rate of 3% has been reported in the eastern part of the country. Of the total population of 52 million, at least 2 million have been displaced within the Congo, and over 300,000 are refugees in other countries. Health services have all but collapsed. Routine vaccination programs have been discontinued, and the one public health program to survive, the UN's polio eradication program, recently came under fire from the International Rescue Committee for consuming too much of the Ministry of Health's time and resources. However, one ray of hope has recently emerged. In September last year, health officials from four rebel-controlled areas met with officials from the Kinshasa government's Ministry of Defense, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and a number of non-governmental organizations that operate in the Republic. Over the next 4 days, the group developed a package of public health measures designed to operate in war conditions. Although the plan at this stage is little more than a list of minimum services, it does indicate that public health can remain a priority even in a time of war. This issue of the British Medical Journal, as well as all the British Medical Journal issues, are available in full online at bmj.com. This is Public Health Radio. I'm Marvin Malik. Our guest today is Paul Sorum, who's here to discuss the French healthcare system. Dr. Sorum's interest in France dates back to early in his career. After receiving his undergraduate degree at Stanford, he chose the field of history at Harvard University, finally completing his PhD thesis on modern French history. That remained a major research interest during the 5 years he served in Chapel Hill's Department of History. Dr. Sorum then switched gears, matriculating as a medical student at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dr. Sorum completed a combined residency program in medicine and pediatrics at Chapel Hill and then Albany Medical Center in upstate New York, where he has settled, at least when he's not in France. At Albany Medical Center, Dr. Sorum is a professor in the departments of medicine and pediatrics, and for over 10 years served as director of the combined medicine-peds residency program. His research areas include quality of care and physician decision-making. The other major area about which he has published extensively is the French healthcare system, the topic of today's interview. Dr. Sorum has been a frequent traveler to France. His most recent journey there was last October. Paul Sorum, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Often in the U.S., we hear that nowhere else in the world do people receive the excellent care we get here in our country. How do the French feel about the care they receive? Are there big dissatisfactions or are they content?
Well, I think that in any country there'll be some people who are dissatisfied, but my impression of the people in France is they're quite satisfied and quite proud of their system. Indeed, that is supported by some polling data. There was a study that was done in 1998 in which they polled people in countries across Europe and compared it actually with a similar poll that was subsequently done in the United States. And France scored not the highest, but was high as far as European countries. 65% of the French said that they were highly satisfied or fairly satisfied, and that contrasted with 40% of people in the United States.
About 40 or 50 million people here in the U.S. are grossly underinsured, meaning they either have a huge deductible or if a major expense occurred, they'd face a financial crisis. And another 40 million or so have no health insurance coverage at all. How does that compare to France? Does the system there cover the entire population?
The system covers almost the entire population. Everybody who is legally in France has, particularly since January 2000, when the final holes really were filled, everybody who is legally in France, and that's almost everyone, is entitled to a basic health care coverage through the normal health care coverage that we can talk about in a minute, or through state public contributions, so that they have access, everybody has access to care. What the law in January 2000 did was to ensure that everybody whose income was below a certain threshold, which included about 10% of the population, would have access to care without being required to pay any co-payments, without really being required to pay anything.
In the United States, there's often a situation where within an industry sector, say auto mechanic shops or restaurants, some employers might provide their employees health coverage, whereas other competing companies may not, and then there's obviously a competitive advantage to the companies that choose not to provide coverage. Is this kind of do these competitive issues come up in France where one company could win out over another due to the health insurance situation?
I think it could come up in a very small way, but maybe I ought to back up and try to explain a little bit about how healthcare coverage is financed. France has a national health insurance system. The four-fifths of the population are in one major national health insurance fund, which is designed to fund the salaried workers, and there are some other minor funds that fund the other people. The salaried workers pay, it's financed primarily by payroll taxes. The employers pay a certain percentage, at least a few years ago it was 12.8% of the payroll. They pay it to the national security system, and particularly to the insurance fund, to the health insurance fund. And the employees pay a portion of their salary as well, so that and again, a few years ago, 6.8% was deducted from the employees' paychecks and sent to pay for health care coverage. So that the health insurance funds are autonomous, or at least semi-autonomous, in terms of the government. So that there's a board that's set up, which is primarily composed of the representatives of the labor unions on the one hand and representatives of large employers on the other, with the labor union representatives dominating, and some representatives from the state as well to act as coordinators. And these quasi-autonomous boards control the taking in of the funds, and particularly control the reimbursement for healthcare expenses. So that the employee, in terms of the majority of people in France, their health care coverage comes through their employment, through the payroll taxes. In addition, however, the people that are unemployed, the people that have that don't fit into this, have lost their jobs or are sick, have chronic illnesses, groups of people like that are then paid for by contributions from the state, so basically tax funds, will be used to funnel into the national health insurance funds and to pay for those people who can't otherwise contribute from their payrolls. These funds pay for them for 75% to 80% of healthcare expenditures in France, but that leaves a portion that isn't paid for. In order to try to reduce the demand, there's relatively high copayments, as much as 30% for office visits, and then for a variety of other services, there'll be more or less, including depending on medications, on the importance, or on whether they're essential medications or not, there's a certain amount of copayment that's involved. So that there's a fairly large potential out-of-pocket expense for the patients. 85% of French people have supplementary health care insurance, and the supplementary health care insurance picks up for this 85% virtually all of the rest of the costs. So it pays for the copayments both for physicians and for drugs and for hospitalizations and for medical supplies. And most of these policies are provided through employment, either through sort of mutual funds that have their origin back in the 19th century, that are sort of labor-organized mutual funds, employees-organized mutual funds, or through private insurances. And there is a small private insurance industry. And the employer can offer a better coverage, complete coverage for more things, so that there's a very small amount of competition that's possible for the employer to say, look, you come to me and I'll give you 100% of everything rather than 100% of most things in terms of insurance coverage. And it ends up that the French people probably pay some 12% out of their own pocket. Once you subtract what the insurance companies and mutual funds and their supplemental insurance have paid for, and then what the national health plans have paid for, there's probably about 10-12% that's left for people to pay out of their pockets.
In the United States, if someone develops, say, breast cancer and then has to leave her job, gets treated, and let's say the person recovers, and then, say, a few years have gone by and she finds another job, she will then find when she gets another job and tries to get health insurance through that job, that they will exclude coverage of her breast cancer, considering it a pre-existing condition. Do you know if that kind of phenomenon occurs in France?
That does not occur. I think that would be, it would be difficult for a French person to understand that line of reasoning, I think. And that I think that the principle is really that people should have health care coverage, that all people should have health care coverage, and that all people should have health care coverage whether they have a pre-existing illness or whether they have a disability, whether they're employed, whatever, being a person, being a citizen of the, or at least a resident, actually, a legal resident of the country, entitles you to health care coverage. So that the sort of scenario you're talking just wouldn't even make any sense in France.
Can patients in France choose their own doctor?
France is perhaps the only country in the world, but certainly one of the few countries in the world, where patients basically have unlimited access to health care. That's an extreme statement. But in the sense that, one, they can pick both their generalist and specialist whom they want. They can go to whatever doctor they want who's available. And there's a lot of doctors in France, so it's usually possible to find a doctor. And in turn, the physicians can prescribe whatever they want within some small limitations. So that there are very few limitations, fewer limitations than in the United States, to consumption of healthcare resources, because of the freedoms of both the patients and of the physicians to consume these resources, to to get these resources. And obviously, that is a potential, but it's a potential problem which, over the last decade, the governments, in trying to restrain the growth in healthcare costs, have tried to introduce a variety of mechanisms to try to put restraints on the freedom of access of patients and put restraints on the freedom of prescription of physicians. And really none of these have worked very well so far.
Are important medical types of medical care, say pharmaceuticals or dentistry or mental health, are they included in the system? How do the French deal with those?
As far as pharmaceuticals are included, and it depends a little bit. If they're deemed essential medications, they're covered 100% by the national insurance plan. If they're the ordinary, they're covered 60%, 65%. If they're considered to be just cosmetic, then they're not covered at all. It ends up being that the coverage is quite good, and the second thing is that drug prices are relatively low in France, since they have basically pretty much a monopoly, the national insurance funds. They can negotiate with pharmaceutical companies to have lower prices, so that the French, one of the ways in which they save some money in their system is to have lower prices for medications. On the other hand, the French consume more medications than apparently than any country in Europe, certainly far more than the United States, and perhaps at least close to consuming more medications than any place in the world. It's difficult to get information about this. The statistics I have are it depends what you count as a medication. But it's clear from my experience as well that watching my friends who come back from doctors as well as participating, as observing people going to doctors, sitting beside the doctor as they see patients, there are a lot more medications prescribed, a lot of symptomatic types of medications. And the French consume a lot of medications. So the price per medication is lower, but the volume of medications is higher, and is one of the reasons probably that the pharmaceutical companies are willing to give lower prices.
And are mental health and dental care provided in the French system?
Well, actually, I think we do a better job in terms of mental health, whereas in France, of course, the MD psychiatrist would be paid for, but psychologists are not paid for, are not reimbursed under the national health insurance systems, except if they practice in public health clinics. So the majority of times when somebody needs to see a psychologist, that person will have to pay out of pocket. And therefore, I think that it really is a system that we may have had, say, 10 years ago when it was hard to find psychologists that would be covered by our health insurance. But once at least with most of the HMOs that I work with, psychological care is provided, and that's one of the ways I think that we've made a great progress and certainly do better than the French in that.
And how about dentistry?
Dentistry is covered, but I don't know to what percent, but dentistry is definitely covered, and I think, you know, in most of our healthcare, a lot of people have dentistry plans that are separate, but as we know, when we're trying to refer people as physicians to get dentistry-type care, that their medical plans generally don't cover dentistry. They have to have separate dentistry plans. But in France, the dentists are covered because, after all, they have to take care of patients too. They went on strike and they got at least a little bit of a rise in the reimbursement rate.
How do the French perform in the area of medical research?
Well, certainly produce, you know, high quality articles and research. Both there's quite a long tradition, of course, of basic science biological research that's done Pasteur laboratories, for example. But there's a number of articles, when looking at the New England Journal of Medicine, for example, very frequently there's a French team that's doing research, which is of high quality and, you know, high enough quality to be published in the New England Journal or Lancet.
Well, Paul, I'd like to take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. My guest today is Paul Sorum, and we're talking about the healthcare system in France. This is Public Health Radio. My guest today is Paul Sorum, an expert on healthcare in France, and the French healthcare system is in fact the topic of today's discussion. Now, Paul, in France, they have relatively high rates of tobacco consumption, and as is well known, they have the highest rate of alcohol consumption among the developed nations of the world. Despite that, despite spending 50% less per capita on healthcare than we do here in the United States, they not only have the high levels of satisfaction with the healthcare system, which you were discussing earlier, but also they have great levels of public health data. For example, their life expectancy is among the best. It's about seventh in the world, compared to the U.S., which is below average at around 15th or 16th. And infant mortality is fourth best in the entire world, and of course the U.S. is the last among developed countries in that area. How do you account for how the French seem to spend less money, have bad personal habits, yet satisfy their public and the public health people too?
I think there's several reasons. First, the French Social Security system is extensive, and it really means that there are few to almost none in terms of people who are so poor that they have that poverty is interfering with their health as well as interfering with their ability to get health care. Secondly, there's surely a lower rate of teenage pregnancy, which tends to be correlated with prematurity and therefore infant mortality as well as infant morbidity. And thirdly, the healthcare that they give is particularly healthcare that people need, whether there may be a slightly less in the amount of frills and expensive frills, but that they're getting the essential healthcare. As far as why they would be able to have less expensive, I guess I've already mentioned one, which was that there's although France is technologically advanced and certainly has a modern and sophisticated healthcare system, there's less use of expensive things such as MRIs, although of course they do exist, so there's less technology expenses. More importantly, however, they have far less in terms of administrative expenses because of the way the structure of the healthcare system. With the fact that if you look at the offices, the doctor's offices in the community, there's very little in terms of administrative expenses that are involved, and that in the doctor's office, it's really for most of the, particularly the primary care physicians, there is the doctor and very little else. There may be a shared a person who answers the phone and makes appointments, but most doctors would have no nurse, no technician, there's no need to have a biller, because for most of the patients they would be paying the doctor up front. There's much less administrative hassle, much less paperwork, so that there's not a need for the administrative overhead in the offices. The the same thing would go would advance to the level of a hospital, where again, with the national health insurance system, and with a budget that's controlled by the state, you have less need for complicated administrative paraphernalia and personnel to do billing and to particularly to do the billing. And on the level of the insurance companies, France, with one major national health insurance fund that has, of course, offices around the country, but it doesn't have this whole series of employees who would be involved with enrolling, with marketing, with the administration of claims, with the denying of claims, with the pre-approval of things, with trying to decide what drugs they would have in their formulary, and this whole administrative structure, which just isn't necessary, as well as, of course, not a executive structure with high salaries and this just doesn't exist in France. So you have that in terms of a further reason why there's not less administrative cost. In addition, costs are lower because of the lower salaries, or the lower incomes, I guess, or reimbursements of physicians. The salaries or reimbursements of physicians are less than half of those in the United States. So that, and once again, therefore, personnel costs, in this case, the work of the physicians, is far less expensive in France. The French consume more physician services. They see their physicians more. There are more physicians, but the cost of the total physician contribution to the total cost is less. In addition, the French spend less per medication than the United States do. With a national healthcare system, they are able to negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies, so that the prices of pharmaceuticals are lower. And some of that is made up for the fact that the French actually consume more medications than the Americans do, so that the total cost of medications consumed isn't all that different. But the French are consuming more, but at a lower cost per drug, and therefore a total lower cost, although not greatly so. And when we put all of those together, we get a lower cost for the healthcare, but a healthcare that includes the basics, and a healthcare system in which all of the population can get the healthcare they need. And that includes, of course, going back now to the question of infant mortality. It means all of the mothers are getting healthcare, as well as fewer of the mothers being adolescents.
Now, you pointed out that doctors are paid a good deal less than in the United States, and I assume that since there's a French tradition of always acting out when you're dissatisfied with your pay, that I'm familiar that in France people do things like strike, and I know that the doctors have been quite restive lately. I was wondering if you could comment on how the physicians are doing.
Well, the physicians are unhappy with their reimbursements, particularly the primary care physicians, particularly the generalists, and 50% of French physicians are generalists. So they have, first there's been a strike since the fall of the generalists in terms of handling after hours and weekend call, and they've been throwing that on to groups that specialize in doing that. But having a government that has not been willing to negotiate with them, or at least to meet their demands for a raise in the basic reimbursement rate, they actually called a general strike a couple of weeks ago, which was widely followed, so that most of French physicians, and particularly primary care physicians, offices closed for a day, and that there's threats to do further general strikes as well. And that's because the basic rate for an office visit, even after a small raise, is only between 17 and 18 euros, which means about $16 for a basic office visit. And this is even after the government actually, it's not the government, the National Health, the insurance fund agreed to a raise in the pay. And I think the physicians are unhappy not just because of the fact that they feel insufficiently reimbursed, but also that the level of reimbursement sort of reflects a social value, and that they feel that the physicians are becoming less valued because their pay has not been rising to the extent that other people's pay has. So that there's an unhappiness, but we have to figure also that, it, as you already mentioned, that there's a French tradition of strikes, and the way that negotiations tend to be done in France is to strike first, not a huge strike, but strike first to get the attention of the person with whom you are bargaining. So that the one-day general strike is to say to the government, we are serious in this, and we need to bargain, or to say to the insurance funds, we're serious in this and we need to have a better deal. And rather than negotiate first and strike, it's really strike first and then negotiate. So that there's actually the strikes for an American appear to be more dramatic than they would for a French person, where this is sort of a natural course of negotiations.
Vive la France.
Oui.
All the developed countries of the world, there are struggles occurring to control health costs. And all the other countries spend far less than we do in the U.S., both in absolute terms or expressed in any terms, whether it's a percent of GDP or whatever. They all spend way less than we do. Yet none of them seem reassured by that. They don't say, well, worse in France, for example, they spend a little more than 9% of GDP on health care, and in U.S. we're up to 15% and it's continuing to rise. They don't seem reassured by that. They all struggle they're all facing inflation in really every country, and they work very hard to control costs, and I know that's true in France. But I just wanted to ask you a question about the French effort to control costs, and in some ways comparing it with the United States, and focusing in particular on two areas. In the U.S., we're going through another round of accelerated medical inflation, and it's been getting a little more publicity in the last 6 to 12 months, and that's probably will continue. And one of the things that happens in the U.S. during recessions and during times when we're trying to cut costs is that we end up leaving more people out of the system. And that doesn't seem to be an option from the point of view of other countries. So that's one issue. And the second one I want to raise is that in the U.S. we've struggled to decrease utilization, in particular of expensive resources such as hospital care. And the U.S. has the lowest rate of hospital admission among the developed countries and very short length of stays. France is average. Their length of stays are far longer than in the U.S., and their hospital admission rate is 50% higher. Instead of focusing on doctors' salaries, have they thought of trying to decrease their utilization of hospital care? Has that been brought up?
Well, the hospitals are under considerable pressure to reduce their budgets. It's one thing that the government really has direct control over is the budgets of the hospitals. But there's a little bit of a contradiction in a way, in that the hospitals, in order to justify their existence and to justify their budgets, they have to spend their budgets. So that there's a perverse incentive there for the people in the hospital to keep their hospitals full and to keep their beds full, rather in order to be able to justify the fact that they're maintaining their budgets. So that I think that's one of the problems in France. But superimposed upon that is a continuing pressure from the government to hold the budgets, and it's the one place in France where the healthcare expenses have not been going up, is in hospitals. In the private sector, France, as in the United States, has recently had sort of resurgence in terms of healthcare costs. At the same time as in the United States, the economic growth has stalled, so that in France, as in the United States, there's a renewed concern over the squeeze that that the increasing healthcare costs are putting on the national budget. So that, and particularly with the government having assumed in recently more of the healthcare costs because of expanding healthcare coverage to everybody. So that at the in contrast to the United States, where a reaction to healthcare problems has been to maybe reduce in various ways the coverage that people have and the delivery of care having the delivery care to fewer and fewer people. In France, it's been quite the opposite, that there's been an attempt to extend care to everybody, even as the healthcare system is going back into a semi-crisis period where they are realizing that they're going to outstrip their budget soon unless they have further controls of costs or an economic recovery.
3 years ago, a UN study group provided ratings in several categories for the quality of healthcare systems in the countries across the world. So, for example, one area that was rated was confidentiality and respect for privacy, a category in which the U.S. actually ranked first. But when it came to access to care and equity, the U.S., I think, ranked 37th or something, we're very poor, especially given how much money we spend here. Now, the French system turned out to rank first overall. Do you know how that came to be? And do you think it was justified?
Well, it's because the French have a very good healthcare system. No, I've read a considerable amount of the debate that this report caused. But it seems to me that on the one hand, the French level of health, the various, particularly the infant mortality, which is one of their major figures, because that was when they had comparative data. And of course, France, as you already mentioned, does very well compared to the United States. But the interesting thing that they did is they tried among the various measures, their final measure of the performance of the healthcare system, what they tried to do is to say, given the resources that a country has, given the healthcare problems that a country has, such as the hostility of the environment and the nature of the diseases, and trying to factor all of this, they sort of said, all right, this is the possible level of health that we could possibly expect the possible level of health that a healthcare system could deliver to its country. And in some countries, that's not going to be as high as others because they don't have as many resources or they have a more hostile situation. And they sort of tried to say to what extent is the healthcare system doing what's possible. And the United States, where we have huge resources, we didn't do so well. And in France, where they have fewer resources, but the population is extremely healthy, they scored well on the ability of the healthcare system to deliver what is possible in terms of keeping its population healthy. We've already pointed out that it's not perfect because think of all the people who smoke and drink too much and therefore have morbidity and mortality as a result of that. But then we think about the coverage that virtually everybody in France has, and they score well on things like that. But I think that one of the interesting things to follow will be to see when they, in the coming years, as the World Health Organization gets more data, how these rankings will hold up. And I suspect that France will just continue to do very well.
So I'd like to end this interview asking you if what lessons the U.S. could learn from France. And I guess I'll go ahead and ask that. And I guess in particular I'd like you to evaluate their insurance system, since it's probably one of the most wasteful aspects of the United States system. We're really bogged down in administrative cost here. And they have the Social Security funds, which I guess are quasi-private or somewhat autonomous. Do you think, and yet they don't compete, so there's not all the expense of enrollment and then also marketing and CEO salaries and all the costs that our private insurance companies take on. Do you think that their insurance system in particular is a lesson that we could benefit by learning from or adopting?
The short answer is yes. The long answer, let me first say that when I've talked with people, or when people have asked me about healthcare in France, and I say it's really very good, they generally say, but it's a socialized healthcare, isn't it? And I always say, no, it's not socialized, or at least not what most of us think about as a socialized healthcare system. And I know we haven't brought that up yet, but I wanted to point out that socialized healthcare, people generally think in terms of the government collecting money by taxes, that the physicians and everybody are in a sense employees of the government and are paid a certain amount either through direct fees or capitation or something. And in France, that's not the case. Most of the physicians, as I mentioned, are paid are private physicians with considerably more freedom than most of the physicians in the United States in terms of the patients they get to see and what they get to prescribe. And are paid fee for service. But what's key is the way that the financing is done, as you mentioned. And what I think we could learn from, and I do think that we could emulate the National Health Insurance Funds. From a physician's point of view, the idea of having a single organization which is responsible for reimbursements, and of course I like the whether it ends up being reimbursing the physicians or reimbursing the patients is very attractive. A single organization which makes rules that we can understand, that we could, rather than a multiplicity of different rules, a single organization that will be responsible for coming up with evidence-based guidelines, as the French are more and more doing, in which there will be one set of guidelines to learn, not a whole set. These are, I think, attractive from the point of view of the physicians, are certainly more efficient in terms of my time and staff time, and I think would be easier for the patients to understand as well. So, yes, I do think that we can learn from the French way of financing their healthcare.
Any other major lessons from France that you think we should look into?
Well, I think it's important to remember that there seems to be an underlying solidarity that's being expressed. The idea that all residents, certainly all citizens, but now all residents of France, should share in certain of the benefits of living in French society, and healthcare is one of the primary ones. It's considered to be an essential benefit to which all residents have a right and should have access to basic healthcare. This is something which doesn't seem to be under question. It seems to be undisputed in France, in contrast to the United States. And I think that we should learn to have that same principle, that there are other things that are going to be competition is going to be important for, and there's something, and people can't have all of everything, but this is one thing that's essential and it's basic to the idea of living in France as it, I think, it should be in the United States.
Well, Paul Sorum, I want to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I hope you'll join us again soon.
I hope so, too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Public Health Radio. Today's public health viewpoint comes from Sherwood Gorbach. Dr. Gorbach graduated Tufts University School of Medicine in 1962. After completing his residency in internal medicine at Cornell Bellevue Medical Center, he pursued advanced training in infectious diseases and gastroenterology, first at New England Medical Center and then in England. Dr. Gorbach has conducted infectious disease and nutrition research in India and Latin America. Currently, he is a professor at Tufts Medical School in the fields of nutrition, microbiology, and community health. Dr. Gorbach has authored 17 books and over 500 research papers, and has had the honor of serving as principal investigator for several research projects funded through the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Gorbach, welcome to Public Health Radio.
It's a pleasure to talk with you. During the recent anthrax scares, health officials have sought to reassure an anxious public by emphasizing that antibiotics such as doxycycline and Cipro have proved effective against this infection. It's not surprising, given the fear level, that many Americans are stockpiling antibiotics. But while antibiotics may indeed seem like our saviors in the shadow of anthrax, widespread usage itself carries dangers that extend far beyond the current crisis. It's an inescapable law of nature that the use of antibiotics leads to the development of superbugs, resistant germs that are not just hardier but also more dangerous than their ancestors. The notion that bacteria can become resistant to antibiotics is no longer just an interesting research question. It has become a concrete and urgent fear as we contemplate what would happen in the event of an all-out biological assault. We cannot afford to squander the effectiveness of antibiotics by misuse. The heavy traffic in Cipro in the anthrax era has spotlighted the problem of antibiotic-resistant germs. But while we focus on the looming consequences of abusing Cipro and the excessive prescription of antibiotics in general, the agriculture industry has already created its own superbugs. For nearly half a century, low doses of antibiotics have been routinely given to healthy farm animals and poultry to hasten their growth and thereby increase profits. Many consumers are unaware of this practice, partly because agricultural antibiotic manufacturers are not required to disclose sales figures. But one conservative estimate is that half of the total antibiotics produced in the United States are administered to animals. And another estimate is even higher. The Union of Concerned Scientists recently calculated that 24.6 million pounds of antibiotics are given annually to pigs, chickens, and cows to promote their growth, and another 2 million for treating their diseases. By comparison, 3 million pounds are given to humans. Whichever figures prove accurate, it is fair to say that substantial amounts of antibiotics are administered to food animals for growth promotion, not for their intended purpose, to treat infectious diseases. The impact of such widespread antibiotic use in agriculture has been of concern to scientists for some years, but it's only recently that we've had proof that the antibiotics are affecting bacteria in potentially devastating ways. Two articles that appeared last year in the New England Journal of Medicine studied chickens being sold in grocery stores across the United States. These grocery store chickens were found to be infected with bacteria that were resistant to three antibiotics, which are critically important in the treatment of human disease. In another study, scientists from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention reported that 1 in 5 packages of ground meat and poultry was contaminated by salmonella, one of the leading causes of food poisoning. Even more alarming, some 84% of these germs were resistant to at least one antibiotic, and most were resistant to several. Other studies have found that Campylobacter, another leading cause of food poisoning, is also becoming resistant to antibiotics. 6 years ago, a drug closely related to Cipro, Baytril, was approved for use in chickens. Since then, the percentage of Campylobacter that is Cipro-resistant has catapulted from about 1% up to 17%. Until now, Cipro has been the most important antibiotic for treating food poisoning by this bacteria. Every year, these two bacteria, Salmonella and Campylobacter, cause nearly 4 million cases of food poisoning in the United States. Many people who develop food poisoning do not require antibiotic treatment, but in other cases, prompt and effective treatment can be life-saving. And as resistant rates increase, these infections will become even more difficult to treat. There is an even greater concern. In mammals, gene transfer occurs only within a species, but gene transfer among bacteria is much more promiscuous. The genes that allow bacteria to resist the effects of agricultural antibiotics have already been documented to spread to other bacterial inhabitants of the human gut. And sooner or later, these genes will appear in bacteria that cause other types of serious illnesses, such as pneumonia and meningitis. The most commonly cited argument in favor of antibiotic use is that these drugs promote growth, supposedly leading to a 5% reduction in the cost of meat. But there is now evidence that the supposed savings are a good deal less. The routine use of antibiotics in farm animals was eliminated throughout Europe in 1997. Economic losses have been minimized by improvements in hygiene, animal husbandry, and the quality of feed. With the publication of these recent articles in the New England Journal, we can now state without hesitation that a major change needs to take place in the use of antibiotics on farms in the United States. First, antibiotics should be used only when prescribed by a veterinarian for treating of individual infected animals. Second, there should be a complete ban on the use of antibiotics that are of critical importance in the treatment of infections in humans. A panel of experts in the field should be assembled to make this determination. Finally, the routine use of antibiotics in animal feed should be banned. Doing so would decrease the burden of antibiotic resistance in the environment and provide health-related benefits to both humans and animals. I encourage you to learn about this problem, become an interested public, and to speak with your elected officials about promoting these proposals that would ban promiscuous use of antibiotics in farm animals. These matters are now up for discussion in the Congress, and public input is vitally needed. Thank you for your interest.
Thanks, Dr. Gorbach. Well, that's it for today's show. This is Marvin Malik. I appreciate your listening. Join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.